We are returning to Matthew chapter 20 this morning. Last week we studied the parable of the workers in the vineyard, which Jesus spoke to illustrate and expound on the theme that many that are last shall be first and the first last. And as we have previously seen with other teachings of Jesus, he was the polar opposite of the Pharisees in that he always lived what he taught. Brother Zach Poonen has pointed out that in the beginning of Acts, Luke states that his account was of all that Jesus began to do and teach. That is, that he did first and then he taught. But then he continued to do what he taught. So it was his teaching was grounded in his life, and it was also validated by his life. He did not teach people to do and then himself go and do something else, as the hypocrites did. So if Jesus, who was to be made ruler over all that is, who was to receive the kingdoms of this world, which we are told at the end of time become the kingdoms of the Lord and of his Christ, if he is to be made the first of all things, as he said, all power is given to me in heaven and in earth, before he ascended to heaven, one would expect from his teaching that he would have to be the last. In order to become the first, he would have to take his place at the last. Not that he did not already have the right as God to be first, but as a man, he became last. He descended to the lowest place before he would be exalted to the highest place. And indeed, this is what we find him addressing directly after the close of this parable. Taking up again in verse 17 of chapter 20, it says, "Now Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples aside on the road and said to them, 'Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem.'" I just want to stop there for a second. Because we know the whole story, and we've heard it many, many, many times, it is sometimes difficult for us to put ourselves in the minds of the characters that lived this and to understand what they would have thought at this time, because Jesus is talking about the kingdom, and they believe that he's the Messiah, and their concept of the Messiah is the son of David who will reclaim David's throne. Jerusalem was known as the city of David. It was his capital. It was the place where he was crowned king over all Israel, and not just king of the tribe of Judah. He was crowned in Hebron to be ruler over Judah, but it was in Jerusalem that he reigned over all Israel. So as Jesus is on the road to Jerusalem, what are his disciples thinking? It's going to happen. This is the time. Jesus has been talking about the kingdom. He said, we're going to rule with him. He said, we're going to have thrones. This part is sticking with them. The other part, they don't understand it. And I think they didn't really want to understand it. But in any case, that's their expectation. It's a very reasonable conclusion to draw if you know the Old Testament and the prophets. The clearest prophecies about the Messiah are about his ruling from David's throne over all the earth. So they think this is what's going to happen. We're going up to Jerusalem, Jesus says, and the Son of Man. Now the title the Son of Man points to his messiahship. This is a title that was used in the prophet Daniel when he talked about the Messiah coming to rule. He said, one like the Son of Man was brought near to the Ancient of Days. So they knew what this meant. And Jesus had, in fact, used it to refer to himself with regard to his messiahship. So they were expecting a coronation. That's what they were expecting. As they were on the road to Jerusalem with the one they believed to be the Messiah, the Son of David, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify. And the third day he will rise again." We've looked at this before. In the minds of the disciples, this had to be something that they just could not process. First of all, Jesus says he's going to be betrayed. That means one of his closest friends, one of his disciples, will turn against him. He will be betrayed to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. These were the people who were supposed to validate his claim as the son of David and the Messiah. They were the ones who knew the scriptures the best. They were the leaders in Israel, and when David was originally crowned, it was the elders of Israel that got together and said, okay, we are all agreed on this, we're going to make David king. So here in Jesus' day, the elders and rulers of Israel, not only are they going to reject his claim to messiahship, it says they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles. This is probably the worst thing that could be imagined, the worst fate imaginable. Rather than being accepted and crowned in his rightful place as king of the Jews, as the heir to David's throne, he will not only be rejected and condemned to death, but turned over to the Gentiles. This had never happened. If you read the history of Israel's kings, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I do not believe there was ever a time when the Jews handed over one of their own to a foreign conqueror. They did depose some of their own kings. They did even kill them, but they did not hand them over. This was perfidy, the worst kind of betrayal for the Jews to hand over their king, their rightful ruler, to their heathen conquerors. They will deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify. Instead of being accorded the honors that were rightfully his as God's anointed and as the heir to David's throne, he will be treated in the most cruel and humiliating way possible. I don't know that we can imagine just how much mental anguish, even the mockery that Jesus suffered, would have entailed. I think all of us have probably experienced some form of mockery at some point in our lives, and you know that it produces a response in most of us of anger. We do not like to be mocked. We do not like to be insulted. We want to lash out with whatever power is at our disposal, which is usually very little, apart from just getting into a shouting match. But think about it for a second. Jesus was God in the flesh. Those who mocked him in comparison to him had no power at all, and he had all power, and yet he was mocked without using it. That, just by itself, would be an incredibly hard thing to endure. Knowing that with a word he could have vaporized those who were mocking him and saying, if you're the Son of God, come down from the cross. He could have done that. But in submission to his Father's will, he did not use the power he had to silence the mockers. He will be scourged. This was a punishment that was so horrible that the Latin word for horrible was actually used to describe it. The word for the scourge, flagris horribilis, I believe, is a way that one Roman author described it. Roman citizens, as we know from Acts, when Paul invoked his Roman citizenship to avoid a situation like this, they could not be scourged. It was not something that was allowed. This was a punishment for foreigners and for slaves, who were quite often punished in this way. The effects have been compared to being shot, blasted with a shotgun at close range. It was the basest kind of humiliation that could be inflicted on anyone, let alone the rightful king of the Jews. And to crucify. And like scourging, crucifixion was intended not only to be a painful, torturous method of execution, it was deliberately designed to humiliate and degrade the one executed, to display that person before the world, to say, this person has no power. We can do to them whatever we want. And the Romans, who were obsessed with power, used it freely on the conquered peoples because they wanted to show those people that were under their domination, look what we can do to your rebel leaders. They have no power against us. We can treat them any way we want to. Crucifixion was, once again, so horrible that the Roman orator Cicero actually said, people should not speak of the cross in the presence of Roman citizens. He thought that it was indecent even to refer to it. So just imagine for a moment, this is the Messiah, this is the Son of God, talking about what's going to happen to him in the place that he should be received and exalted and honored and worshiped. He is instead going to be betrayed, rejected, mocked, humiliated, and killed. Instead of going to the throne directly, he's going to the cross. His disciples, as I said, did not understand, probably because they did not really want to understand. In Luke's account of this time, Luke chapter 18 and verse 34, he says of the apostles, but they understood none of these things. This saying was hidden from them, and they did not know the things which were spoken. In another place, it says that they didn't understand, and they were afraid to ask. Now, as we will see in a moment, they were not afraid to ask for certain things or about certain things. They asked Jesus questions all the time. They didn't ask him about this. What were they afraid of? I think they were afraid that he meant exactly what he said, that somehow this was the fate that the Messiah was going to suffer, and they just couldn't comprehend that. And so, in a sense, it almost kind of went in one ear and out the other, even though Jesus was as clear as he could possibly be. This is exactly what is going to happen to me. They just didn't get it. Verse 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he said to her, what do you wish? She said to him, grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on your left, in your kingdom. So, Zebedee's wife, the mother of James and John, was hardly alone in her ambition. The gospel writers tell us that there was a continuous debate right up to the night that Jesus was betrayed. The apostles were arguing among themselves about who would be the greatest. Her approach was just unusually direct. She and her sons went straight to Jesus and said, we'd like to be the greatest, if you don't mind. That is precisely what is implied. Those who sat at the right hand, at the left of the ruler, were his closest, most trusted advisors. They were the ones who had the inside scoop and the power. And they thought, why not? We'll just go and flat out ask him if we can be the top dogs. This obsession with dominance, with comparison, is so built into human nature that it shows up in early childhood. I don't believe it was adults who invented King of the Mountain. Just watch kids on the playground and see if they don't arrange themselves into some kind of pecking order. You can even see it in the animal kingdom. But it is hard-coded into our fallen human nature. We want to rank ourselves in comparison to others, and of course, everybody wants to be on top. So James and John thought, well, Jesus said we were going to have thrones. I wonder where our thrones will be. Huh, maybe we could get the jump on everybody else and just ask for those thrones right next to Jesus. And I think that Jesus' response shows how incredibly patient he was. Imagine for a moment that you have just told your closest friends what's going to happen to you. Imagine you told your best friend, I have cancer and I'm going to die a horrible, painful death within 3 months. And your best friend said, can I have your truck after you're gone? I think this was probably what this was like for Jesus. Because there's no indication that they were like, what? That's horrible. What are you talking about? How can we, you know, it was just. And I'm sure we have all been that way with God at times. And so concerned with what we want that we miss completely what he's doing. But Jesus was so patient and so loving that he did not respond as we might have in that situation, saying, why are you talking about, I just told you I'm going to be betrayed and killed. Why are you even bringing this up? He didn't rebuke them. And we know that he did, these very disciples, he did rebuke them at other times. It was James and John who asked, do you want us to call down fire on the Samaritans? And he said, you do not know what manner of spirit you're of. Son of Man's not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. So he did rebuke them when called for, but for their cluelessness in the way that they responded to his predictions about his death, about that he said nothing. He addressed their hearts. Jesus answered and said, you do not know what you ask. And they truly did not. If they had been paying attention to what he just said, if they had understood what it meant, the parable, that in order to be first, you must become the last, then they might have realized this is a very loaded question. When you say, I would like to be in the top spot, what you're saying is, I would like to be at the bottom of the heap. I would like to have a mountain fall on me. But they didn't get that. They really didn't. They really just were thinking about ruling and thinking about their status. But there's something in that that's not entirely wrong. I said it last week, I think, but once again, and I say it often, that it's not wrong to want things for yourself. It is not wrong to be ambitious if your ambition is directed towards the kingdom of God and not towards the here and now. In the way that they approached it, in the timing and other elements of this, they were probably pretty off the mark. But in that they desired greatness in the kingdom of God, they were not wrong. Because that is given as a motivation. We just heard Jesus 2 weeks ago telling the disciples, this is what you're going to have. When Peter asked, what will we have? He said, this is what you're going to have. Obviously, he intended for them to be motivated by that. And it was not wrong for James and John to desire greatness in the kingdom. What was wrong is that they didn't understand what that entailed. You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? They said to him, we are able. So he said to them, you will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared by my Father. So when I was growing up, I used to think that this was almost a little bit of a trick, in that Jesus didn't immediately respond by saying, I can't grant your request. He first got them to commit themselves to drinking from his cup and being baptized with his baptism. But I don't believe that that's really what's happening here. Once again, I believe Jesus was answering their hearts, the best part of their instinct, that they were asking for the very best that God had to offer. So by getting them to commit themselves to paying the price, he was giving them the best possible shot at what they asked for. He didn't guarantee it to them. He didn't say, you will have it. He said, I can't give you that. That will come from my Father for to whomever it's been prepared for. But if it's going to be you, this is what it's going to entail. You will have to go where I'm going. If you want to be greater in the kingdom than anyone but Christ, like right underneath, then guess what? In here and now, you will have to go lower than anyone but Christ. No one could ever go lower because he was made sin for us as the sinless Son of God. It's not possible for anyone to go lower than that. But it is possible to go pretty low, and most of us will never come close. And that, I believe, is what Jesus was talking about. Can you drink the cup? Can you be baptized with the baptism? Can you pass through the death that I'm going to die? Not just physically, but utterly to self, to your will, completely become nothing. If this is what you want, if you want to be at my right hand or my left, if you want to be the greatest in the kingdom, you're going to have to be last. You're going to have to be in the lowest place in here and now. So naturally, the rest of the disciples didn't like this particular approach that James and John took. And when the 10 heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. And this was not because they were so humble. It was because they wanted the top spots too. But Jesus called them to himself. One of the things that distinguishes the character of Jesus and the way he operated is this aspect, that he taught at close range. He taught in the context of a relationship with people who watched his life. Sometimes, I have been guilty of this, and I know many who are, we tend to kind of lob the teachings sort of over the wall at people. Or we try to teach them or help them from a removed distance. Here's something you need to fix. You're wrong about that. Come see me when you've got that figured out. Jesus was not like that. Before he even addressed this, it says he called them, it's actually one word in the Greek. He called them near. He called them to him to teach them at close range within the context of their relationship with him, where they could observe his life, his character, that he walked out what he taught. He called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them." So the first thing he does is he gives them a negative example. The two words that he uses to describe the leadership model of the world both begin with a Greek preposition kata. And that preposition means down or against. It can also mean other things, but those are the main meanings. You think of our word catapult, that comes from the Greek to throw against or down. So you have katakureo. That means to lord against. The word kurios means lord, once again kata, against, to lord down or to lord against. And then there's katexousiazo, which is to exercise authority against or downward. What you can see in these word pictures is that the leadership model of the world, the world's idea of greatness, is all about how high you can get, and in the exercise of leadership, in the exercise of authority, it is all downwards. When you are at the top of the heap in the world, what is happening? Everyone underneath you is trying to take your spot. This is exactly what Jesus saw happening among his own disciples. James and John ask for the highest position, and the other apostles immediately begin to grumble, because they don't have a right to that. I'm sure they thought of lots of reasons why they should be the ones at Jesus' right and his left. So you've got the people underneath who are constantly trying to rise and to take the leader's spot. The leader is using his authority. He's exercising it downward to keep them down so that he can stay on top. So that's the negative example. That is the word picture that Jesus draws of a downward exercise of leadership from those who are called great. And here's the key. These are the key words. Verse 26, "Yet it shall not be so among you." Sometimes I feel like we in the church act as though Jesus never said that. And we just copy the things that we see in the world, and we're like, well, that seems to work. They get results, They're able to raise money. They're able to build big buildings and have programs and do all these things. We'll just do what they do. Jesus said, look at that. That's how they do it. Don't do that. That's what not to do. We need to understand that what he taught when it comes to leadership, when it comes to greatness within the body of Christ, within the church, is the exact reverse of what the world does. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. The word is diakonos. It's where we get our word deacon. And it was a word that was sometimes used of the king's ministers, and it literally means someone who runs errands. In other words, the work that you do is not for yourself, but on behalf of someone else. So Jesus is bringing down their idea of leadership from the one who sits there and orders other people around and tells other people what to do to the one who is told and goes to do it himself on behalf of the person he is serving. But if you think that sounds reasonably respectable, as our word deacon has come to be, okay, there's more. Whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. You know who had the absolute lowest status in that society? Guess who had no rights? Who could be flogged or maimed or killed just on the whim of a master? Doulos, slave. So Jesus couldn't have been any more clear. It's like, you're thinking about status, you're thinking about greatness in terms of how high you can get. I'm telling you, it's about how low you can go. If you want to be at the top, find the bottom. To everyone that you would lead, to everyone that you would be greater than, you must be less than. You must be like a slave who has no rights of his own, no property of his own, totally devoted to the interests of someone else. That's the life of a slave. And that is the position that Jesus took. Crucifixion, flogging, humiliation. That's what happened to slaves. He was the king. But he said, this is what's going to happen to me. I'm going to take the place of a slave. And not only that, but he was treated as a worthless and unfaithful slave, although he had done no wrong. So those who would follow him, those who would be at his right hand and his left, have to walk the same road. Verse 28, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. The Christ-like model of leadership, if you want to talk about authority, if you want to talk about greatness, you take the arrows that are described by those words that Jesus used about exercising authority down, and you if you want to be great, if you want to be the first, if you want to be the leader, then you go as low as you can go and you get underneath everyone else and you use that power to lift them. Because that's what he did. He didn't stand above us and throw us a rope and say, grab this and I'll pull you up to where I am. He came down and got underneath us, lower than anyone could possibly go, to the point of becoming sin so that he could lift us up on his shoulders. That's what biblical leadership, authority, power, and greatness look like. Is you get underneath those you serve and you lift them up. Paul admonishes us in Philippians 2, verses 5 to 8. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So we need to ask ourselves, if we call ourselves followers of Christ, what is our daily mission? What are we motivated by? Jesus did not come to be served, but to serve. Are we looking for other people to serve us? I know I am sometimes. Whenever we think in terms of, I have a right to this, Jesus had all the rights, but he took the place of a slave with no rights. He never asked anyone to serve him. He could have demanded it, but he didn't. The purpose in his coming was to serve us, his creatures. And not his faithful creatures, but his rebellious creatures, who were as far from him as we could be, and no desire to be otherwise. He came to serve us. Is that how we look at people who are a pain and a nuisance? How can I serve? How can I be your slave? Or are we thinking, what can you do for me? What should you be doing for me? Or not doing to me, as the case might be. Slaves have no rights. Are we looking to be appreciated? You know, Jesus said, when you've done all these things, you should say, we're unprofitable servants because we just did our duty. Slaves don't expect to be thanked. We did all these things. Well, that's what we were supposed to do. Because we are slaves. As Paul said, slave to Christ. We don't need to be appreciated. Are we looking to get as high as we can within whatever realm is available to us? And in some realms it's quite meager. Some realms it's a pretty big deal. But the human nature in any realm where you can get higher is to exercise power downward to get your will done. I think one of the ways in which this is most abused is in the Bible's teaching on marriage, and when husbands get the idea, oh, I have authority, I can tell my wife what to do. If that's your motivation, you're already on the wrong track, because that's not what it's for. It's not to get your will done. Authority is always given, if you're rightly representing God, to lift someone else up. We have to lead, not from above, but from beneath. If taking the place of a slave was good enough for the Son of God, is it good enough for us?